Good morning. You are listening to Raven Radio. Today is Wednesday, August 21st, 2013. I'm Holly Keene, and this is Raven News. The city of Sitka won the latest round in a fight over whether voters can approve property sales at Sawmill Cove Industrial Park. Sitka Superior Court Judge David George ruled on Thursday against supporters of a ballot initiative that would give citizens a vote on large land sales and leases. It is the latest development in a years-long saga that's seen the case go all the way to the Alaska Supreme Court and back. KCAW's Ed Ronco reports.
The Sawmill Cove Industrial Park is a huge chunk of land that used to be the site of a pulp mill. Now the city sells and leases parcels inside the park to companies that want the space. The area is meant to attract business to Sitka, and sales and leases inside the park do not have to follow the rules that apply to other city land. Since 2008, Jeff Farver and Mike Littman have been trying to change that. They wanted to give voters final approval on large pieces of land sold or leased at the site. A vote would be required for sales worth more than $500,000 and leases worth more than $750,000. But the city refused to give their initiative a green light and kept it off the ballot. Farver and Littman sued, and the case made its way up to the Supreme Court, which last year sent it back to Sitka Superior Court for another look. And that brings us to Thursday.
It's a little disappointing to see a judge lurch off and make a decision that I think is inconsistent with the earlier Supreme Court directives in this very case.
Juno attorney Joe Geldof represents Farver and Littman.
It really goes to the heart of whether or not the citizens are going to have any say, or whether we're going to just allow the bureaucrats and the lawyers for municipal governments just basically say, sit down, be quiet, and we're the experts. Let us determine how we should rule our communities.
Geldof says he does not understand why the city fought so hard against giving voters a choice. Michael Gaddy, an Anchorage attorney who represented the city in the case, says there's a reason.
The community elects representatives to represent it on certain matters. And while certainly people have the ability to initiate or refer matters to the ballot, they also are limited in that regard with respect to some of the principles, particularly if something is related to an appropriation or an administrative matter.
Basically, Judge George ruled that the initiative violates Alaska law in two ways. One, it makes an appropriation by giving voters the power to steer money away from the park. The law holds that only legislative bodies, like a city assembly, can make appropriations. And two, it steps on the city's administrative power. Initiatives can make law, but they can't tell a government how to run day-to-day business.
We're pleased with the decision, and we think that it's supported by appropriate legal analysis and authority.
Geldof obviously disagrees. He says his clients had lots of support for their initiative when they circulated petitions back in 2008, and that city officials should not have fought the initiative his clients wanted on the ballot.
6 years into this, I have basically had it with small-minded people trying to squelch. You know, what's really a straightforward initiative proposition.
Geldof says his clients are still considering whether to appeal Thursday's decision.
You know, at a certain point, people like Jeff and Mike, they just get worn out. You know, that old adage about apparently you can't fight City Hall kind of comes to mind here. But, you know, City Hall and a lawyer that's just bent on an obstruction, they seem to win all the time. And that's bad news for democracy on the local level throughout Alaska.
Sitka has a new city attorney and a new assembly since the lawsuit was initially filed. Still, the current assembly voted to continue fighting the case. Whether that battle goes on to yet another appeal is now up to the initiative's supporters. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Ed Ronco.
There are other legal issues in the case brought by Sitkins for Responsible Government, most notably the voter approval that Farver and Littman were hoping to impose at Sawmill Cove Industrial Park is already required for municipal property sales elsewhere in the city. Raven News will take a look at some of these issues during our broadcast tonight. Five totem poles were raised on Prince of Wales Island during a three-day ceremony last week. KRBD's Sean Carlson attended the events in Klawak and has this story.
This is the sound of dozens of feet shuffling in unison. The guy you hear on the megaphone, Nick Nickerson, leads the procession from the front in an orange construction vest. And, as you will soon come to know, Everything here is accompanied by music. The Shuffling Feet belong to a diverse assortment of men and boys. Native or non-native, young or old, short or tall, they all work together, carrying a massive piece of cedar wood on their shoulders. But this isn't just any group of men carrying a giant piece of wood. They are participating in a 3-day clinket ceremony that will see 5 totem poles raised into position in Kloak on Prince of Wales Island. This particular totem is the mythological Raven Pole. It takes the group of men, followed by onlookers and a traditional clinket singing group, only a few minutes to carry the thousands-pound pole from the carving shed to Kloak's Totem Park. A large crowd has gathered in the park to watch the men hoist the pole onto a stand.
Give him a hand, ladies and gentlemen.
Thankfully today, the sun is out. The same cannot be said for past years or even the final day of this ceremony, during which at least 100 people stood for hours in a drenching downpour. The weather today is welcome because the work isn't done after the men carry the pole to the location. They roll it over and tie ropes to the top, and it's then, when Nick Nickerson switches from the bullhorn to a microphone, that the real fun begins.
Okay, have your attention. This line right here is the power. This line right here is the heft power. That line down there, you guys are going to stabilize it. As it goes up and we say halt, then we'll just keep tension on all the ropes.
That banging noise you hear. Wait, we almost forgot. There's music for this, too. Anyway, that banging noise is a large piece of metal being hammered into the base of the totem. But what's going on around the pole is worth explaining. The long ropes tied around the top of the pole are stretched taut. On the other ends are groups of at least 20 people each. Under Nick's direction, they have hoisted the pole up, and until that nail is hammered in, they are the only thing keeping the massive totem from falling over. When the pole is finally bolted into place, the crowd cheers again, this time for themselves.
Give yourselves a hand. Nice job.
The carving of these poles, along with others in the totem park, was led by John Rowan, who has been working on totems since he was a child. He says, though, that he owes his knowledge and passion to other masters in the craft.
I learned at my father's knee, where I really got into it. It was when I went to high school, and Stan Marsden, who's a Simsion master carver, was instructed in the school. And he's the guy that introduced me to, you know, like Nathan Jackson, who's just phenomenal, and where I'm at today is because of all of them.
The totems for this ceremony, along with others that have stood in Kloak since the 1990s, are known as mortuary poles commemorating the dead. They are reproductions of original carvings from Tuxacan, an ancestral winter village of the Tlingit people. The Great Depression-era Civilian Conservation Corps had recarved the ancient poles in the 1930s, much like many of the poles found in and around Ketchikan. But due to time and age, Rowan has been charged with reproducing them again. The carver didn't build all of these beautiful totems by himself. He was aided by a number of students of his from the Kloak School, where he teaches carving. For the past 2 decades, Rowan has brought up students from early grade school until they are off to college, cultivating new carvers along the way. Around 8th grade, Rowan knows which students he wants to help him carve poles. It's then that some of them get to join Rowan in his workshop.
Because the school's different, you know. But once I leave the school and I start out at the shop for the city, then it's a job. And nice Mr. Owen gets left at the door, and mean Mr. Owen gets is who they see. And what they're learning, you know, good work ethic, which is, I hope, is what I'm doing.
During the ceremony, 2 plaques were unveiled, one listing the names of the carvers in the 1930s who recreated the poles from Tuxacan. The other commemorates Rowan and his students. The celebration in Kloak included more than just totems. Patrons browsed a native arts market during the days, and the nights featured potlatch feasts with food, dancing, and, well, you guessed it, cue the music. Hundreds of people gathered in the Kloak School Gymnasium each night to dine on crab, salmon, ham, salad, asparagus, potatoes, and, well, the list goes on. Tlingit dance groups from all around the region, including Ketchikan, entertain the crowd with songs of love and life. Devlin Enderstrom dances with the group from Yakutat. The 16-year-old sees the totem-raising ceremony as an important uniting force for Tlingits throughout the region.
I really feel like this pole-raising, it's also lifting up our spirit as Native people, and I think it's it's good and healing for us to be able to do something like this for Tlingit people all across Southeast.
20 or so poles have been raised so far since the early 90s, and both John Rowan and others in Kluwak say there are more than 100 to go. Reporting in Ketchikan, I'm John Carlson.
An aide to U.S. Senator Mark Begich tells Petersburg officials that U.S. Coast Guard has no immediate plans to relocate or decommission a Petersburg-based cutter and says plans to bring in new larger cutters to Southeast may be delayed. Bob King, a legislative assistant to Senator Begich, sent an email response to Petersburg Mayor Mark Jensen this month. King wrote that he contacted Coast Guard headquarters about the fate of the 110-foot cutter Anacapa, which does search and rescue missions, homeland security, and law enforcement out of Petersburg. King writes that officials at Coast Guard headquarters say they have no current plans to take the Anacapa out of service or change its home port. Local officials wrote to the senator this summer asking about plans for replacing the fleet of aging 110-footers and asking to keep both the Anacapa and the buoy tender Elderberry or their replacement ships in town. Mayor Mark Jensen says it's nice to have the Coast Guard here, and he hopes the ships are in Petersburg for many years.
53 people, I believe, are associated with that ship being in town. You know, there's kids in school and people in the workforce, and be a shame to see that go away for the community, I would think.
And that's all for Raven News. If you've missed any of our stories or you would like to hear them again, please visit us online at kcaw.org. And here's a look at Sitka's own weather. It's currently 57 degrees downtown Sitka under overcast skies. Today, a chance of showers in the morning and then showers in the afternoon. Highs around 59. Tonight, patchy fog with showers likely with lows around 51. Northwest wind 10 miles per hour. You're listening to Raven Radio, KCAW in Sitka.